Well, there you heard New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, along with Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, Delaware Governor John Carney, and Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo joining New York Governor Andrew Cuomo as they announce the opening of a reopening task force as the states begin to look toward getting business open again in the Northeast. And dovetailing with that, to some extent, is our Medical Monday today. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. Dr. Clouzette specializes in internal medicine and infectious disease. Dr. Clouzette attended medical school at the University of Pennsylvania, then conducted her residency in internal medicine at Columbia University Medical Center. She also did an infectious disease fellowship at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and an epidemiology fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. If you would like to be a part of today's truncated conversation, give us a call right now and get in line, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll also take a few emails if you wish. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Clouzette, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for playing it by ear here and waiting a little longer than usual. But that was important information. And I don't know if you caught any of it. The governor's now talking about very cautiously and taking that first step toward reopening business and the economies in general. As someone who has studied epidemiology very closely, what has to happen before that happens?
Well, I mean, I think cautious is the important word there. So we have to make sure that we have a good plan in place for identifying people who are infected with the SARS coronavirus 2, or the virus that causes COVID-19, and be able to have a good plan for isolating and quarantining those people to prevent an outbreak like we've had. So it will take a lot of thoughtful consideration and a lot of pre-planning before those decisions are made, in my opinion.
Governor Cuomo, for the last couple of days, has been mentioning that New York State cases, specifically downstate, may be plateauing. First of all, do you see that and do you agree with that? And second of all, tell us what has to be shown in the statistics to say, okay, we're at a plateau now.
So we're actually seeing similar trends here in Dutchess County. And so what we've been seeing is that the number of patients who are coming in to the hospital have actually been pretty steady. So we're seeing a pretty even number of patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19 as opposed to an increase day on day. So that's what we would consider a plateau. We haven't seen a steady decrease yet, so we're really just determining whether we're even reaching that peak before we hit the downturn. So that's where we are, and we are seeing similar trends as in the city as what's being reported.
We are joined on this Medical Monday by Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. How many patients with COVID-19 now at Vassar Brothers?
Today, our number was 76 total.
And have you been dealing directly with these patients?
Largely indirectly. So what we are trying to do for a number of reasons to minimize exposure both to our healthcare workers, but also, as a lot of people have heard about, our limited personal protective equipment, which we're in better shape now. We've been trying to minimize the number of people who go into the rooms or the units with our COVID positive patients. So largely this is limited to our nurses and the primary physicians who are taking care of them, either the intensivists or the hospitalists. And so specialists like myself tend to do our consultations from afar, either remotely speaking to the patient on the phone or even just having a conversation with the primary physicians to discuss the patient's case to minimize those entries into the COVID units.
Having studied infectious disease for so long and worked around it, what is different about this one, if anything?
Well, I think what's different is that we haven't really experienced an outbreak like that, like this, really since I can remember. In 2009, when I was a resident, we had H1N1, which felt similar in some ways, but in a smaller scale. So I think we're dealing with an unprecedented amount of patients with a specific disease, struggling with the potential lack of resources, both in PPE and planning ahead for both space and ventilators and all of the equipment that we need to take care of these patients. And this is not how we're used to practicing medicine. We're, you know, typically very resource rich and don't have to think about these things. But this has put us in a very different position as healthcare workers to make decisions and policies and practices in order to take care of these patients.
At this point, do you have enough ventilators?
We do. We do. We are able to take good care of our patients across our system. So Vassar Brothers is part of a health system, Nuvance, and all of our hospitals. Although stretched in some ways, we are still not at beyond capacity.
We're joined today by Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. Our number is 800-348-2551. And let's go to the phones. Joanna in South Hadley has been waiting a very long time. Joanna, you're on.
Thank you. I seek clarification, two-part question, about the word treatment. All of us have been hearing about intubation and ventilation, but I'm asking for your thoughts about what treatment do patients entering hospitals who aren't ventilated receive? And the second part is a home care question. If people are self-isolating with COVID, what self-treatment can they give, including how to treat a fever and any other suggestions for self-care you have? Thank you.
So those are good questions. In terms of treatment, I'm assuming that the question is more leaning toward medications. We're often used to being able to treat a lot of our diseases. Unfortunately, for COVID-19, there are no known effective treatments. So there are several drugs that have shown to have in vitro, in other words, in a test tube, activity against the virus, but haven't necessarily shown clinical outcomes with treatment of COVID-19. So what happens in a time like this when we have nothing else to offer, sometimes physicians will try any number of medications that are otherwise available and may have potential benefit and see if it works in these patients. Unfortunately, what we know now is not much. So a lot of the treatments that we're trying, you may have heard a lot about hydroxychloroquine. There are no real good data showing that it's beneficial, and there may even be some data that it could be causing harm. So, you know, we're really trying to straddle that line of trying to help patients and treat them, but also not harm them in that attempt. So right now, if the Infectious Disease Society of America has actually put out a guidance that recommends not treating with anything outside of the outside of a clinical trial, where we can actually assess whether patients will truly benefit from a treatment or not. So the best care is supportive care. So managing these patients with supplemental oxygen, obviously treating any secondary symptoms they may have, and that's probably potentially the best that we have right now. There are some drugs that we are investigating as parts of trials, including convalescent plasma. So convalescent plasma is when patients have an infection and they recover from it, their immune system will make antibodies against it. It's how our vaccines work, for example. So what we and many other systems are trying to do is find people who have already had the infection, who have presumably developed antibodies, and have them donate blood. And then we take the part of the blood that has the antibodies and infuse it into another person. The nice thing about convalescent plasma is that it's actually very safe, because we know that blood transfusions are safe. They're used all the time. There are obviously always risks and side effects to anything that we do in medicine, but we know generally that that's very safe. So we're hoping that proves to be beneficial in patients, and we at least know its safety.
Joanna, thanks a lot. We have to take as many calls as we can here, so we'll move it along. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Canine, feline, and porcine coronaviruses are mainly gastrointestinal diseases. Are there any GI symptoms associated with the human coronavirus?
Also a good question. So initially when the reports came out from Wuhan, China, they were reporting that there were very few GI symptoms associated, and it was largely respiratory as well as fever. However, as more and more clinical reports have come out, we know that about 20% of people can have diarrhea or other GI symptoms. And if you include loss of appetite as a GI symptom, it can be anywhere in the 40 to 50% range of people having those symptoms. So even though they're not the classic symptoms, they can be part of the symptomatology with COVID-19. They have found the virus may be present in stool, but what that means, we're not sure, just like with a lot of things with this virus, since it's so new and we're just gathering data.
Dr. Valerie Clouzette is our guest from Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. A shortened version of Vox Pop today. It's a Medical Monday. 800-348-2551, the number. Bob in Rhinebeck. Bob.
Hi. Since this terrible pandemic has started, we've been hearing a lot, and deservedly so, about the heroics of physicians and nurses. Well, we haven't heard very much about the heroics of registered respiratory therapists across the nation. A lot of the public doesn't realize that probably a good 75% of intubations in hospitals are done by registered respiratory therapists, and almost 100% of ventilators are managed by registered respiratory therapists. So they are in the thick of it, and I would sure appreciate a shout out to my 160,000 colleagues in the respiratory therapy profession across the country.
Thanks, Bob.
I second that shout out. They're the frontest of the front lines.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Clouzette is here from Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. And let's go to Anita in Clinton. Anita.
Hi, I was wondering what the role of cytokines is and how we can produce more of them in our bodies.
So it's a good question. So cytokines can be both helpful and harmful. So they're what are produced by our immune system to help fight infections, whether it be bacterial, viral, fungal. The problem is that sometimes when the cytokines when a virus or an infection induces a cytokine surge, that can actually be what causes a patient to get really sick and have a lot of these symptoms that we end up seeing in these downstream effects. So it may be that the lung damage that we're seeing from in COVID-19 is actually related to the immune response and not necessarily the virus itself, or some combination of the two. So it's hard to say whether we should be increasing the cytokines, because actually some of the recommendations are not recommendations. Sorry, some of the drugs that are being trialed with this disease are actually inhibitors of certain cytokines to try to dampen down that what we would call cytokine storm, and hopefully prevent some of those downstream effects that may be happening because of the robust immune response.
Anita, thank you very much for the call. We are joined today on this Medical Monday by Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. We'll take a brief break and then get back to more of your calls and your emails. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 1-800-348-2551. Joined today by Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. And we talk about coronavirus specifically and infectious disease in general. This email came in, Dr. Clouzette, from Carolita. And the question is postural drainage being used to help with COVID patients? Should anyone at home with COVID practice postural drainage if they're not sick enough to be in the hospital? First of all, tell us what that is.
I'm actually not sure.
Okay.
Postural drainage.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not sure.
I might be saying it wrong, but it is. Postural or postural drainage. No idea? Okay, well.
Not that I can, unless it's a term that's used for something else. I'm not sure. Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. You know what? Usually we stump the band at least once on this program. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Crystal in Pine Hills. Crystal.
Yes, I have a question. My doctor, my son was taken care of in Kingston Hospital in October by a doctor with infectious diseases. He came down with anaplasmosis. I'm sure you're familiar with that. He almost lost his life. Why can we not have a vaccination against Lyme disease in this country?
So anaplasmosis and Lyme disease are two separate things, but I think your question is good. So Lyme disease, even though they're both carried by ticks, anaplasmosis is from a different bacterium that causes infection. But
he did have a tick. He had a tick, only he didn't find it early enough.
Right.
Right. Yeah, so you know, there was a history with a Lyme disease vaccine, and one was created, but it probably wasn't effective enough. And in fact, if you have a pet, they get the Lyme disease vaccine. So it is no longer used in humans, but it's certainly an area that requires a lot more research because it is definitely endemic and causes a lot of morbidity in our community here. It would actually require two separate vaccines, one for anaplasma and one for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. But I agree with you. I think that we do need further research, and there seems to be more and more as unfortunately our numbers of Lyme disease and tick-borne diseases increase. There's more interest in funneling money toward research in those areas.
Crystal, thanks very much for the call. Valerie Clouzette, Dr. Valerie Clouzette is our guest today. 800-348-2551, the number. Vanessa is in New Paltz. Vanessa.
Hi, I'm calling because I have heard, and I'm not sure if it's true, that on top of this being a respiratory illness, this is COVID, that there's a malfunction of the red blood cells and their ability to carry the oxygen to where it needs to go. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that, or if that's not even true.
Well, there was a report that recently came out that looked at the where the virus is binding and how it's potentially binding to a certain area on the hemoglobin molecule, which is what carries the oxygen in our blood. So there are some studies showing that that's potentially one of the causes for the poor outcomes. It's just difficult to make that definitive connection, but you're correct.
Right. Yeah, so that would that change treatment options, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
We have sort of talked about it a little bit briefly. As far as I know, any treatments that would be targeted at that, we don't necessarily think would be safe because they would cause other potential side effects. So as of now, there's nothing directed at it, but knowing more information certainly puts us in a better place about the disease and the pathophysiology of the disease, puts us in a better place to identify potential treatment options. But so far, based on that recent report, I haven't heard anything.
Vanessa, thank you very much for our call today. It's a shortened version of Vox Pop, and a reminder that we are scheduled to have Governor Cuomo in a half-hour conversation live with Alan Chartok at 3:30 today. As you know, with the nation in lockdown, the schedule, the broadcasting schedule is a bit different than normal, and we have to do this. And it's important to get the information out there. So we'll be hearing from the governor at 3:30 with Alan Shartok. Meantime, Dr. Valerie Clouzette is here from Vassar Brothers Medical Center answering your questions about coronavirus. And Larry in Wilbraham, Mass. Larry, you're on.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Clouzette, I've heard Dr. Burke throw out information saying the sensitivity of a test. Do you have any information about the sensitivity and specificity of testing for both COVID and the antibody test? I think we all expect that when we get a test and somebody says you're positive, or you're negative, but what if the coin ends up on its edge and you could be falsely positive or falsely negative? And I'll stop there.
All right. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, this is a question that comes up a lot. And unfortunately, we don't actually have good sensitivity and specificity data on our tests, because what that requires is a gold standard, and we don't have a good reference standard since this is a new infection. So we're sort of figuring it out as we go. I can tell you that some, you know, one of the things that can affect the accuracy of the test or the sensitivity of the test, meaning how well it can detect people who have the disease and actually show as positive, is how you collect the specimen. So you may or may not know, but the test is what's called a nasopharyngeal swab, where they stick a Q-tip, a long skinny Q-tip, yes, to the way back of your nose, essentially to your throat. It's really uncomfortable to swab and try to get some of the virus onto the tip of the swab, and then they run a molecular test to look for the RNA of the virus. And so if that swab is not done properly, you may not get enough of on the specimen, on the Q-tip, in order to for the test to turn positive. So in addition to the test itself, there's other factors that may affect its sensitivity. So we don't have hard numbers. Based on some clinical experience, I've seen anywhere between, and again, there's different tests across the country and across the world, anywhere in like the 10 to 30% false negative rate, meaning that a patient who has the disease but the test turns up negative can be true. So we have to take all of, just like every diagnostic test, we have to take it with a grain of salt. No test is perfect, is what I always like to say, because we can't take any diagnostic test for 100% certainty, and certainly not a new one.
Larry, thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551, the number. Dr. Valerie Clouzette is here from Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Bob in Wineskill. Bob, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yep. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. I tend to think a little differently than a lot of people, but there was a lot on the news a couple years ago about a machine that I guess bars were getting that vaporized alcohol so you could breathe it in. If you were to breathe in like 100 proof vodka, would that tend to attack the coronavirus in the lungs directly?
So it sounds like that could probably be more dangerous than helpful. What can sanitize and kill the bug in the body is very different than what will in, you know, on surfaces. So, you know, on surfaces and on our hands, we want to use something at least with at least 65% alcohol, which, by the way, vodka is only 40%. So you'd have to super distill it in order for it to be at a sanitizing level that we use, you know, for like in the hospitals, for example. But the virus itself actually gets into cells. So just having like a topical application or an inhaled application, I don't know that it would work. And I think that you might have some downstream effects of side effects related to it. But I like innovative thinking.
Well, thank you for that call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Marilyn in the Adirondacks. Marilyn, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to share an article my son forwarded to me, and then have the doctor just comment her thinking about it. And that is to the effect that, yes, it may be a virus that sets off the illness, but that the real degree of illness that different people experience, or none at all, may depend on their own personal intracellular toxicity. And that would, of course, vary with people widely. And that's what gets set off and released that creates the terrible side effects, almost parallel to like a cytokine storm kind of concept. so what they have found in France is that ozone early on seems to detoxify the body and other detoxifiers, and they seem to find maybe a correlation of toxicity to the amount of electromagnetic field exposure that you get, especially with these new 5G stuff. So that's the essence of it, and I wonder what you think.
I haven't read that, and I'd be curious to see the article. But there are so many things we don't understand about the virus itself and the body's reaction to it. And it's true. I think each person has very idiosyncratic reactions to the virus. In some ways, it's very predictable how people will behave, and in other ways, it's completely unpredictable. So in other words, the timing of when people present with the illness and such can be pretty predictable, but how people are going to manifest is a little bit more difficult. So I would like to see the article and read about it. It sounds interesting.
Marilyn, thank you so much for calling. 800-348-2551, the number. Dr. Valerie Clouzette of Vassar Brothers is with us today. Rachel in Poughkeepsie. Rachel, you're on.
Thank you. Doctor, I just wanted to ask a question. I am a nurse that works in a health department. I talk to a lot of people every day about their symptoms, people who've tested positive. And one thing that comes up over and over again is a loss of taste and smell. Not everybody, but that seems to be a consistent theme in at least half of my calls. Do you have anything to comment about that or how that happens?
So I agree. We started noticing that as well, that was one of the symptoms. Even in people with very mild disease, that was one of the symptoms that they were complaining of. Mm-hmm. There have been some theories as to why maybe there's a direct viral attack on the sensor, the sensory cells in the nose, which ultimately affects your taste as well. But I haven't seen anything definitive yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Well, Dr. Valerie Clouzette, we are nearing the end of this program, and I hope you can come back on a day when we can do a full hour here. I'm just wondering, and I ask this about many doctors and experts that we have had on talking about coronavirus and COVID-19, how optimistic are you that this thing will be behind us by midsummer?
It depends on what you mean by behind us. Do I think the worst will be behind us? Absolutely. I think, back to your original point and what Governor Cuomo was mentioning is that we have to be very thoughtful about the lifting of isolation and quarantine restrictions in order to prevent the outbreak from worsening again. I think ultimately our best answer will be a vaccine, but I think that we will be able to manage it if we have a good plan on how to identify people who are sick and their direct contacts to try to isolate them and prevent another outbreak like we've had.
Have you seen speed like this with regard to a vaccine before?
Speed, I guess, is in relative terms. They're estimating that it'll take about a year to a year and a half, which I think is a pretty realistic time frame.
In other words, to roll it out. But the testing and the various recipes, if you will, have already been in production now. Is that a little quicker than usual?
For the tests that are being created?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yes, and it's part of the issue is that, especially for the antibody test. So a PCR test is actually a pretty quick test to create because all you need is the gene sequence, and then they can create the test. It's the antibody test that's a little bit more complicated because you have to identify the proteins on the antibodies first. You know, have to find patients with antibodies, et cetera. And the FDA has a really rigorous program for approving all kinds of tests. They're actually, some of the tests that they've they're not even calling it approval. They're sort of giving access to that haven't undergone all of this rigorous testing. So we have to take all of these with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
So it's happened quickly, but partly because the stringent regulatory processes are a little bit loosened in a time of crisis, which I think is reasonable.
Yeah.
But it also should give us a little bit of pause when we're using these tests to make sure that, you know, they're making sense relative to our clinical sense.
Well, Dr. Valerie Clouzette, that's it for today. I hope you come back again. It was so informative. So great to have you here. Support comes from Dr. Jean Chen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniation, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Thanks to Zach Malloy, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it is a special. Hard questions, real answers. COVID-19 and the economy. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.